We want information. Information. Information.
Who are you?
The new number two.
Who is number one?
You are number six.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
Ministry of Truth. I'm Gordon Comstock, and we're going to be reading today. The ministry is going to be investigating, right? The late Maureen Heaton's unpublished manuscript, The Impossible Dream, and when she means impossible dream, she's talking about the tendency of the oligarchs of the world, the Illuminati, call them what you will, Papa Nero's purple and crimson boys, but their tendency to pursue a new world order. It's impossible because when they're finally going to pull it off, well, we're about there. They're going to get the Great Tribulation. Jesus is going to come back and drop some elbows on all of the sinful oligarchs involved. Then he's going to judge everybody else. It's impossible. You're not going to have this perfect utopia. But Maureen Heaton wrote this book, this unpublished manuscript, pointing out, just highlighting the scurrying cockroaches and their activities. And so this book, this manuscript, The Impossible Dream, it comes highly recommended by the Iserbeets, Sam and Charlotte. And anyway, today we're looking at chapters 11 through 14. Here goes. The late Maureen Heaton's unpublished manuscript, The Impossible Dream. Chapter 11, It Doesn't Make Sense. Let's face it. Many of the activities taking place today don't make sense. Neither those being carried on in the name of government, nor many which, to all appearance, seem to have no connection with government. So I may be forgiven if I suggest that there is an overall pattern which provides reason to believe there is a connection, even if none is visible. Whenever something does make sense, from a customary point of view, logic would indicate that there is a point somewhere from which cause and effect would become demonstrable. For instance, some there are who still ruminate over the government program in the 30s in which thousands of piglets were destroyed, mountains of potatoes were poisoned and buried, and oceans of good milk were poured in the streets of America's heartland. All this at a time when Americans were selling apples and pencils on street corners, trying to get enough cash to feed hungry families. Even the stated reasons for doing these things did not make sense to most Americans. But they certainly made sense to Henry Wallace, then Secretary of Agriculture, who instigated the program. Things being done today are in the same category. Does it make sense, A, for government to force a citizen to give up some of his lawfully acquired property in exchange for permission to build on what is left? Does it make sense, B, to deny permission for a citizen to build anything on his property until units in another jurisdiction on land owned by other citizens have been built? Does it make sense, C, to continue to send aid and trade to the Soviet Union when we are protecting other countries from the Soviet quote-unquote evil empire by sending aid and trade to them? Does it make sense, D, to commingle the essence of such vastly different cultures as the totalitarian USSR and the USA quote-unquote free society with student and educational exchanges? These are but a few of the ridiculosities in a continuing process of overt government initiation. Consider now a few which do not evidence government as a source. A. The widespread illiteracy among young adults. B. The dramatic decline of moral standards nationwide. C. The incessant, unyielding exposure of incidents asserting the perfidy of elected officials. D. The astronomical suicide rate among teenagers. E. The appearance of the street people. I guess she means homeless. Or F, the proliferating incidents of child abuse and mass murder. Does it make sense, A, to ignore and the easily does it make sense to ignore the easily checked fact that the first two of these sad states were predicted at the time would result from the innovations initiated in education in the government schools more than 40 years ago? Does it make sense to ignore the easily checked fact that the first two of these sad stats were predicted at the time would result from the innovations initiated in education in the government schools more than 40 years ago? Or that the third one up there has a 20-year history of a planned assault, or that the fourth was not considered as a possibility until about 20 years ago when death education began to become part of the curriculum in the government schools, or that the fifth one above can be traced to the revisions in treatment of the mentally ill, or that the sixth, there is no serious attempt that has been made to determine a cause for the sixth. Year after year, and for many years, Americans from border to border and coast to coast have wrestled with these ridiculosities, and a thousand more. Whence come these nonsensical situations? Why so many? How have they continued to plague the citizens in the face of constant resistance? If this government is operating under the Constitution, that's a big if, the citizens should have the last word. If it doesn't make sense that those elected to office won't listen to that word, then why doesn't it? Let us then create a position from which all the myriad seeming idiocies do make sense. Insistently over the years, there has been an undercurrent of opinion in this country, particularly among the upper echelon of society, which speaks of an intent to create a world authority in which the United States of America would become one of many states in a United Nations of the world. A small voice lost in the babble of third world demands. While it may seem a new development to many Americans, the efforts to establish that world authority have been actively pursued since World War I. Strange as it seems, many of the strategies being described in this book have been standard operating procedure all along. The peace at any price movement, the fear tactics of the anti-nuke movement, the International Organization to Keep the Peace, quote-unquote, have loomed large from the beginning. In the exhibits section of this book, there is a photocopy of someone from, oh boy, it's cut off, I'm sorry. The margin's cut off. From an issue of the Student Quarterly magazine of Pasadena, California. High School for November 23. Those who have succumbed to the idea that, quote, now that there is an atom bomb, we must not have another war, unquote, will find the lead article in that quarterly interesting, at least. Entitled, quote, The Prevention of War by Means of a United Nations of the World, unquote, the article begins, quote, We are told that the next war will last only 3 days, possibly a week. At the end of that time, all the people on this planet will be dead, unquote. It continues with arguments promoting the, quote, United Nations of the World for 3.5 pages of a very slim magazine, building a picture of, quote, the only hope for peace, unquote. Some of these arguments are only too familiar today, like this one, quote, National sovereignty should exist only so far as it does not interfere with the function of the world government, unquote. The article ends with, quote, The United Nations of the world will not be a complete success until all the nations of the world have joined. In the meantime, education of all the people of the world will do more than any other thing in helping to realize this ideal, unquote. Skeptic that I am, Maureen Heaton is, I questioned whether a student actually wrote this propaganda. My skepticism was justified at a later date when research revealed the source for these unusual quotes. See the documents section. Okay. For the purpose of this discussion, the source really doesn't matter. What is important here is what can be learned from this almost 70-year-old document. That lesson includes exploring the evidence that it is miseducation which is making it possible for this dream to be realized. Consider these statements of record. 1. A United Nations in 1923? 2. An end to national sovereignty in 1923? 3. A super war without survivors in 1923? Yes. Oh, wow. Maureen Heaton, where'd she find this? So this article really referenced nuclear bombs, United Nations, an end to national sovereignty in 1923, long before those were supposedly invented. Wow. This smacks of the mid-1800s letter from Albert Pike to Mazzini, those two Illuminati scions, where the Three World Wars thing, where he predicted that. Wow, that's too prescient. That's creepy. Okay, getting back to Maureen Heaton's words. Yes, she says, in 1923. And ever since then, the cry of peace, peace, when there is no peace. Almost three-quarters of a century of promoting internationalism, of implanting concepts in students' minds instead of giving them the tools to create their own concepts. And how? Of attacks on citizens who wantonly keep bringing up the Constitution and its horse and buggy, quote-unquote, methods of governing, of deliberate promotion of promiscuity, pornography and prurience. America Firsters, they were called, all those who openly decried these aberrations, parentheses, as though putting America first was a bad thing for Americans to do. End parentheses. Super patriots, 100%ers, right wing, extremist, isolationist, ultra right, radical. What is wrong with being patriotic? What is wrong is that patriots are inclined to expose the soft underbelly of deceit and trickery needed to change the course of history. They are apt to insist on facts truthfully presented. They are prone to argue that it is not the people who cause wars. They are prone to get in the way of quote-unquote progress. Progress toward that one-world dream, which they see as a nightmare. They do not hesitate to point out fallacies and deceit, and those who use these to destroy tried and true methods of governing. It is to allow the most powerful men in the world to continue garnering ever more power that patriots are purposefully stripped of their respectability. It is for the same reason that human lives are callously sacrificed, whether by wasting away in the gulag or blown apart in quote-unquote wars manufactured by the power-hungry. Dreams of power have ever ended in pools of blood. Ambition most often leads to a premature grave for the quote-unquote dreamer, as well as his victims. And yet, the Damoclean sword continues to be ignored, despite the lessons of history. In most persons, there is an innate something which, even despite years of subordinating personal desires to enforced obedience to tyranny, despite deprivation, suffering, calculated pressures for a man to believe that his country was responsible for his travail, causes him to throw himself face down on the good earth of his native land as he steps off the plane which bore him back from agonies suffered at the hands of today's barbarians, and to kiss a handful of dirt. This is the basic instinct of which the poet wrote, quote, "Breathes there a man with soul so dead that never to himself has said, 'This is my own, my native land,'" unquote. There are such beings, undeserving of the name of man, consciously negate this basic human urge. They ridicule those whose souls cry out against willful destruction of a cherished heritage. For such, the poet had words, today's power-mad deceivers and their minions, their lickspittle cooperator minions should heed. Quote, "If such there be, high though his title, proud his name, boundless his wealth as wish can claim, that wretch shall go down to the vile dust from which he sprung, unwept, unhonored, and unsung," unquote. Unless, of course, the 100-year war against honor, duty, country succeeds in its stated purpose of changing the nature of man. In which case, the world will finally have been made safe for tyrants. And to them alone will be the glory. Then it will all make sense, because Big Brother will see that it does. Any facts which do not support approved official dicta will quietly disappear down the memory hole, and every human being not cloned from Big Brother will be a genetic duplication of Winston Smith. And of course, wow, that's from 1984. An allusion to it. Chapter 12. The more things change, ... Colonel Tom Hutton had been a public relations officer working out of Flying Tiger's headquarters in Kunming, China during World War II. From that vantage point, he observed that something new had been added to the arsenal of war. Until the middle of the 20th century, 9 basic principles of warfare had been utilized by military forces. An objective, or goal, the initiative, or offensive, movement, or flexibility, mass, or consolidation of forces, economy of forces, minimum effective need, surprise, security, and or intelligence, cooperation, simplicity. When Colonel Hutton recognized the use by the Soviets of what he later termed, quote-unquote, the dominant principle, parentheses, dominant because it can pervade all the others, end parentheses, he dubbed it SPX, Soviet Principle 10, and he identified it as paralysis, in particular, paralysis of the will to resist. His research found it had been activated by the Soviets and used experimentally on their own people before being integrated into official Soviet military policy. In his military capacity, Colonel Hutton regularly reported to his superiors on the activation and use of this new principle in the pressures to topple the anti-communist government of Chiang Kai-shek. He documented the participation of the United States State Department in the use of this new strategy against an ally. For this contribution, Hutton was awarded the Legion of Merit, which was presented to him by Generals Chenault and Wiedemeyer. After the war, as a private citizen, Colonel Hutton formed an external alliance with other ex-intelligence personnel to study this technique and to exchange information about it. In time, the group took the name of SPX Research Associates, or SPXRA, and began sending intelligence reports to military and other official personnel with a need to know. When the Berlin blockade was set up by the Soviets, Colonel Hutton was recalled to duty and ordered to Germany to serve as chief of intelligence in the military government which had been created to guide that benighted country back into civilization and self-government. During that service, he saw further evidence of SPX, which convinced him that SPXRA should be a continuing ex officio body, and it was registered as such with the Office of External Intelligence Research. Oh, Maureen, she's going to continue hitting us with acronyms. Oh, I hate acronyms. Bear with us, folks. For 17 years, SPXRA competently, quietly, and unofficially did a job which should have been the responsibility of the War Department or its successor, the quote-unquote Defense Department. SPXRA did that job thoroughly, well, and at no cost to the taxpayers. In 1958, the continuing advances of the communist offensive for global conquest seemed to make it imperative that not only officials, but concerned citizens as well, should have the information SPXRA was developing. And they authorized release of their reports to patriots known to them to be responsible and reliable. Colonel Hutton began to lecture publicly on aspects of SPX which were considered to be in the public interest and of public concern. The first big offensive move SPXRA took against SPX, getting hit by the acronyms right and left, was a staff report on, quote, the Supreme Court as an instrument of global conquest, unquote, which was presented at a hearing of the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security. In that report, the staff of SPXRA documented the SPX presence in recent decisions of that, quote, unquote, guardian of the Constitution, in relation to the impact of those decisions in aiding advances of the communist movement. That report was immediately suppressed. Naturally, right? It was brought to public attention only through a private organization, which printed and distributed it for SPXRA. It was Colonel Hutton who first broadcast the facts about the communist nature and Soviet support of the Castro forces in Cuba on a nationwide hookup. It was Colonel Hutton who drafted the report which told the truth about the rebellion of the freedom fighters in Hungary. That report inspired a congressional resolution that would require free elections in the slave states behind the Iron Curtain as a prerequisite for further cooperation between the United States and the Soviet Union. Parentheses. That effort was scuttled by the State Department. So much for congressional influence in matters involving the unholy alliance between the land of the free and the home of the slave. End parentheses. These items are but a sampling of the numerous counterattacks by SPXRA against the revolutionary assault on these United States. Following release of some of their reports to those selected few patriots, officers in SPXRA became convinced that there was a need to know by a much larger section of the American people, and a series of study courses to bring public attention to bear on this phenomenon was begun. A quadrilogy in the form of a series of taped lectures was planned to divulge the history, strategy, tactics, pressure patterns, objectives, and techniques involved in SPX. Each segment of the series addressed specific areas of enemy strategies which were taking this country at an accelerated pace into what was then described as the quote-unquote communist orbit, with no knowledgeable resistance to this essential element. The hope was that, without knowledge of those strategies, the American people would be able to effectively respond to enemy penetrations and thus forestall the forced march into servitude. Only two of the segments of the documentaries were completed, Know Your Enemy and Red Empire, when Colonel Hutton became seriously ill and had to disband SPXRA. He died shortly after that. What a coincidence, right? As recent events have developed, Colonel Hutton and his work have gained added importance. With the installation in our government of the planning, programming, and budgeting system, the threat SPX holds for the future has become crucial. This system is the overt embodiment of SPX, and there is no one of stature today who is putting the meaning of its use into the frame of global conquest, as Colonel Hutton and SPXRA did for so long. The book has the same core concept as prompted SPXRA's quadrilogy, but that is the limit of the resemblance. Those readers who may have been among those who received the SPXRA briefings will recognize that immediately. But if any still have the briefing papers put out by SPXRA and review them now, they would be amazed to find how relevant they are today. While SPXRA identified the enemy as Soviet communism, that fact does not in any way detract from the work they did. In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the preponderance of evidence validated that thesis. Information available today which indicates that the Soviets are as much controlled as the puppets they control does not change the record of communist activities. Somehow, it seems to plumb the depths of depravity even deeper, to know there may be hidden puppet masters pulling the communist strings. The enemy, called communism then, still exists today, still pulls the strings, still continues its inexorable advances toward the goal declared by the communist leaders. That goal is the same one pursued by Adolf Hitler. It is the goal of socialists of every hue, from the Fabians to the international workers of the world. like-minded elitists, wishful thinkers, collaborators, and self-appointed do-gooders wrap it in their own brand of ideology, but they all march to the same drummer. The international cabal of financiers and monopoly capitalists have that same goal. From the evidence, there is reason to believe that these are the power behind all the other movements. The facts about that goal are as valid, regardless of the germinal source, whether it be the Kremlin, the city in London, Bilderberg Palace, the plush offices of the international bankers, or the paneled halls of the United States State Department. Communist lackeys, whether skulking in the back alleys of Palo Alto, coming out of the closet in San Francisco, parading red flags through the state capital of California, or massed in the streets of Tehran, have been and are now doing the jobs needed to reach that goal. No one has identified those jobs and placed them in global perspective better than SPXRA. No one, except perhaps the junior senator from Wisconsin. No one came closer in the 1950s to exposing the real puppet masters than SPXRA. As they related the involvement of official departments of our government to the activation of Soviet Principle 10 in this country. As a demonstration of the depth of SPXRA analysis, let me paraphrase for you the closing statements in that first course of the unfinished quadrilogy which SPXRA prepared in 1961. In doing this, only the date is changed to 1989, and the names of some of the locales. This demonstrates the identical strategy still ongoing. Quote, if your strategy maps are properly posted, you know how gravely the global situation has deteriorated since we began these briefings. The first quarter of 1988 was typical of intangible enemy gains not measured by lands conquered or populations enslaved, but by preparation and maneuvering for such gains later. Quote, these pressures are not entirely explained by the fact that State Department forces which engineered the fall of nationalist China, 1945 to 1950, are again in control. Quote, there is more to it than that, as demonstrated by the farcical SALT talks and proposed treaty. Enemy is operating from positions of power and assurance. He counts his gains everywhere, not accepting the American zone of Panama and the turmoil in a number of South American countries. The leverage under South Africa and its pro-West government, the Cuban troops in Angola, the pressures in all of Africa, the tragic prelude to disaster in Iran and its aftermath. Quote, enemy's gains do not end there. He is watching with satisfaction State Department's moves in the Far East and the disbursement of his victims in Indochina. Quote, enemy is now certain he can finalize his goal at any time of his choosing. He is confident of the reaction from the American president. It is his conviction that be kind to Moscow, quote unquote, is the theme of the American executive no matter who lives in the White House, unquote. May God rest the soul of Colonel Tom Hutton, who gave full measure of devotion to the country he loved and set an example of courage and objectivity and patriotism which can only benefit all who truly treasure individual liberty and oppose communism and all its handmaidens for exposing the fraudulent premises on which its goal is based. Oh, I really wish she would have written later on, repeated what all those SPXs meant. Chapter 13. The Communist Myth. Okay, Maureen, redeem yourself. Come on. No more acronyms. Sporadic investigations of radical movements of every hue occupied official bodies in the United States for over 60 years, reaching a peak after World War II. The voluminous hearings and reports which resulted have exposed communist theory, tactics, and strategies, and created an indisputable record of perfidy which almost defies belief, while lesser cooperators in this country have been the usual target of such hearings. Occasionally, larger fish have been caught in the nets of committees charged with protection of the security of these United States. The involvement of such luminaries as James T. Shotwell, Owen Latimore, and Alger Hiss in this official record of subversion are indicators of a higher level of power and influence than has ever been officially documented, and of the presumption of a cabal behind them, which has remained untouched in official records to this day. Generally, those investigations accepted the communist movement as an alien conspiracy with global conquest as its goal, and their work was limited by that concept. Three investigating bodies in the 50s, which attempted to pursue the possibility of an American connection of substantive importance within the One World Movement, were summarily halted. Gee, I wonder why. Those members of such committees who insisted on finding answers to the questions raised were viciously attacked, their integrity impugned, their funds withheld, and their careers effectively destroyed. When American citizens attempted to do the job their representatives were unable to complete, the vicious attacks were turned on them. The infamous Fulbright/Reuther memoranda kicked off the official beginning of, quote, anti-communist, unquote, government policy, which brought an end to legislative committees on internal security and marked as, quote, unquote, extremists, irresponsible and not respectable, those citizens involved in researching and reporting on the power, influence, and extent of subversive activity behind surface events. Even in the 20s, communist subversion was an established fact in this country. The voluminous Lusk report of the New York State Legislature documented the penetration of radicals into government positions in that state before 1920. It was a raid on a secret communist tactical meeting at Bridgman, Michigan, in the mid-20s, which catapulted J. Edgar Hoover into his long career as head of the FBI. Given the accepted thesis that that subversion stemmed from and was directed by the power structure in the Kremlin, which had subverted the revolt against the Tsar in Russia, what could possibly have motivated the Roosevelt administration to, quote-unquote, recognize the collection of inhuman brigands in Moscow as the legitimate government of that benighted country? Even in the 20s and 30s, the Russian people were, quote, voting with their feet, unquote, as waves of refugees braved the dangers of a policed border, desperately trying to escape the most cruel oppression known until that time. There is no conceivable excuse for the administration in Washington not to have known that tyranny was official policy in the Soviet Union, and that agents of those Soviet tyrants were actively engaged in subversion in this country. There is no rational explanation for bestowing quote-unquote respectability on that illegitimate band of scofflaws by such recognition, unless one posits that there was a linkage between them and the super elite in this country. Thank you, Maureen. Yeah, well, read Animal Farm by George Orwell. That will come through. It has been established that there was involvement of the elite financiers in the United States and London in the Leninist abortion of the Kerensky Revolution. The goals of communism and those of the establishment here are compatible. Yep. Again, read Animal Farm by Orwell. The strategies and tactics of both are interchangeable. By placing American foreign policy in the frame of an intent, as acknowledged by the then head of the Ford Foundation to Norman Dodd, counsel for the U.S. Senate committee investigating the foundations, to, quote, so manage the affairs of the United States that it can comfortably be merged with the Soviet Union, unquote. It is possible to discern, then, the logic of Roosevelt's, quote, unquote, recognition of the Soviets. Given these factors and that mutual goal, the question must be asked, how and when were the goals of the United States changed and by whom? Officially, they never were. Factually, it happened in the early part of the 20th century. But the American citizens were not informed of it until Dwight David Eisenhower's elite committee was given the task of enunciating the new goals for America. It was in response to those unannounced goals that this nation was programmed for the managed and controlled future planned so long ago. Only after those goals were in place could the planning, programming, and budgeting system, PPBS, be activated. That system has now been installed throughout the various governments, federal, state, local, and of course in the schools. As of 1990, the PPBS, Planning, Programming, and Budgeting System, is already operational on a massive scale, with only a comparative few rural areas yet to be brought online. It is a moot point whether its capability is not already too entrenched in this battle for the mind to permit a reversal. That cannot be determined until a major attempt is made to short-circuit it. Time is of the essence. With each passing day, exponential numbers of citizens succumb to this systematic control. Every day, inroads are being made into those few remaining non-conforming enclaves of government. Attempts to bring attention to this truly vital movement into total control are being successfully diverted in the same way a magician diverts his spectators by centering attention on unrelated movements. Internationally, the issue of the quote-unquote communist threat and its multifaceted activities, with the added confusion of so-called quote-unquote democratic movements, the quietly executed erasure of the Canadian-American border, whew, man, has that ever been heating up since 1990, especially this year, in 2007-2008. The proposal for a buffer on the Mexican-American border, the continuing focus on Central/American unrest. Nationally, the NSC Iran gate, the Hydra-headed political issues, including the quadrennial election, the payoff to the Japanese internees, the travails of the Attorney General, the probes of elected officials, the radical changes in Supreme Court decisions, the so-called drug war, and on and on. Locally, the flames of long-burning issues are fanned, or new issues are whipped up to distract attention from the installation of computers, replacement of quote-unquote outdated accounting and budgeting practices, hiring of systems experts, quote-unquote, etc. The hard reality of a clear and present danger is obfuscated by the lingering, quote-unquote, threat of the communist myth. Chapter 14, Money and Conspiracy. The world in which financiers, bankers, accountants, and tax protesters move and do their thing is a foreign country to me, says Maureen Heaton. It's not that I haven't tried to understand, nor that I don't recognize the crucial role of quote-unquote legal tender in such matters as I do understand, such as conspiracy, treason, and such like liberties of sin. I do know that the love of money and the power it brings are at the root of all our troubles. But I get lost in the maze of semantics which surround the money issue. So I don't write about that area of the problems besetting mankind, usually. I even try not to think about it. Despite my blind spot, I am about to make an exception, parentheses, for cause, as you will see, end parentheses. Possibly the first expert to try to explain, for such as me, to get us to pry open the money-made mysterious conundrum and find the hoax inside was one W. H. Harvey, who created Coins Financial School, a fictitious establishment back in 1894. Harvey dedicated his school to the cause of making money unmysterious. It is not my intent here to discuss his books on finance and related matters, which I have read, but to report on one I haven't read. If there are any copies around today, they must be beyond price. This subject book is also about money, but its main theme is the relation of money to, quote, a gigantic conspiracy, international in scope, conducted with vast resources, indomitable in purpose and daring, and resulting in ends toward which the destruction of the people's money was but an initial step. Holy mackerel. Maureen, you got to be kidding me. 1894 this guy wrote this? Parentheses. Quote is from a review by the Chicago Times, included as a supplement in Coyne's Financial School, called Up to Date in 1895. Wow. How prescient. Okay, back to the book. Now, as I said, states Maureen Heaton, quote-unquote conspiracy, I do understand. Mr. Harvey apparently did, too. He must have had some inkling of suspicion that his, quote, The Tale of Two Nations, unquote, which is the book in question, The Tale of Two Nations, that it might be consigned to the non-book department, even as he wrote it, for he took the unusual steps of including the Times review of it in one of his M-O-N-E-Y books, and inserting two chapters of the tale in another. Ooh, how about that? So he pretty much, it sounds like this W.H. Harvey guy predicted that his most important book about the money conspiracy of the oligarchs of the world would be suppressed and buried. And so he did include a couple chapters in other books he wrote. How interesting. Wise man. Anyway, the Times Review notes that while the tale is a quote-unquote romance, some of the characters in it are, or were, real people. And some of the events really occurred. The author inextricably tangled fact together with fiction, and even thinly disguised some of the real people, so as to make them appear fictional. Some of my contemporaries will be convinced, as I am, that there was even less fiction in the tale than was noted by the Times reviewer. I'm sure that the following selected quotes will make the point. Quote, two bankers and financial operators met in London one evening. Dot, dot, dot. Baron Roth, the host, was a portly, well-fed, brainy diplomat and financier. Dot, dot, dot. His guest, Sir William T. Kline, like himself, was very wealthy, dot, dot, dot. Both believed in the power of money, dot, 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 unquote. The Baron began, quote, I wish to talk with you, dot, 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 about something bigger, dot, 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 than either of us or all of us together have ever undertaken, dot, 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 for more than a year, dot, dot, dot. I have been trying to satisfy myself as to the effect a single standard of money would have if adopted by the whole world, dot, dot, dot. I know now exactly what the result would be, and that it is feasible, dot, 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 unquote. At that point, the two went into a lengthy discussion about silver and gold, bimetallism, and legal tender, such things as your poor scribe cannot discuss. The Baron wound up with the statement that, unless her course were altered, the United States would supplant the British Empire as creditor nation of the world, and wind up, quote, richer than all Europe, unquote. He said the plan he had devised would destroy that potential, that by demonetizing the U.S. currency, the rest of his goals would be realized. The second chapter begins with more discussion about money theory, but quickly turns to the mechanics of strategy and tactics for activating the plan, And that's where the plot thickens. Sir William protested that the Yankees were too smart to allow such manipulation, but the Baron smugly replied, quote, "This is a one-man's world. One man on the Finance Committee in the Senate, and one man on the same committee in the House, and £100,000, and the job is done," unquote. Again, Sir William protested, quote, "I think you have underestimated the integrity and sagacity of the American Congress. The proposition will be combated, and it will raise a storm throughout the Republic, and your agents will be powerless," unquote. The Baron patiently dealt with this remonstrance. Quote, "But you do not understand the conditions. A bill can be presented to reform the coinage laws. This bill, on its face, would not demonetize silver, but as enrolled, it would. The interdelineation of a line or the changing of a word in the bill, as finally recorded, would be as we desire it. I doubt whether it would become known for several years," unquote. Again, Sir William interposed an objection. "Yes, but when they do discover it, a cry will go up, and repeal will be inevitable. The public will..." Unquote. The Baron interrupted. Quote, "The public be damned. Once enacted into law, it can be maintained. Every moneylender and banker in America will arraign himself on the side of the new law. Money has no patriotism. The combined wealth of the United States will support the law. They will not see the general wreck and bankruptcy that will ultimately come, pulling most of them down with it. To repeal the law would require both houses and the president. You can risk our friends in Wall Street to take care of one of those three. Sir William, I would not undertake it were I not so sure of the woeful ignorance of the masses." "Alas, me too," says Maureen Eaton. "On the subject of money..." Oh, these son of a... You know what's these... Wow. These, this brood of vipers, right? The money... The money lords. Quote, "When the effects of our plan set in, they will act like a nest of rattlesnakes in dog days. They will wriggle and twist and bite each other." I can't believe this was written in 1984. In 1894, this is unbelievable. "They will lay it on everything but the right thing. It will establish two classes, the rich and the poor. The first to enjoy this world, and the other to live by waiting on the first. We must crush their manhood and independence by making them poor. They then make good servants and gentle citizens," unquote. Oh my gosh, sounds like Orwell's prophetic, dark, ultra-pessimistic quote from O'Brien at the end of 1984. If you want a picture of the world, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. Yeah, well, that's without Jesus Christ, though. I don't know how you atheists do it, man. What do you even get out of bed for? Okay, getting back to the book, we're almost finished with chapter 14. In that statement, returning to Maureen Heaton's words, in that statement is the kernel of the goal of the conspiracy which has devastated this country in fact. And it was written almost 20 years before this plan was made operative in 1913. Later, the Baron told how he would protect the co-conspirators in the American Congress. Quote, "When Congress is about to adjourn, things are done in a great rush. In rare instances, bills are vetoed on without being read. An explanation being accepted instead. It is usual to grant a member the right to have his speech printed in the record without ever having delivered it. In this way, we will have no trouble in showing afterward that the bill, as passed, was explained to be just what it was, unquote. And now I ask you, says Maureen Heaton, gentle reader, who understands M-O-N-E-Y, was that what happened in December 1913 when a majority of a minority of Congress approved the quote-unquote Aldrich Plan and passed the Federal Reserve Act? Yeah, Maureen, that's what happened. Addendum. Shortly after this chapter was published as a regular column, I received a package in the mail in a plain wrapper with my name as returnee, as well as addressee. In it was a paperback copy of The Tale of Two Nations. Now that I have read it, I wouldn't change a word of the content of this chapter. Maureen Heaton. Wow, somebody sent her a copy of that anonymously. Okay, those were chapters 11 through 14 of the unpublished manuscript by Maureen Heaton called The Impossible Dream. The reason I'm reading it, folks, you know, once in a while I will get, people will tell me, you know, why? Have guests on. What are you reading books for? Well, there is a minority of people. I'm one of them. You know who you are. A minority of people who are audio learners. Now, just by the fact that you're listening to shows like this on the internet tells me there's a pretty strong chance you're one of us. You are an audio learner, as opposed to being a visual learner or a kinesthetic learner. And so as an audio learner, you may have from time to time gone to the library and checked out or ordered from other libraries audiobooks. Or maybe you do the audibles.com thing or recordedbooks.com, whatever. You know what I'm talking about. You get some cool books that way sometimes. You get a lot of reading done while you're driving the car, folding the clothes, whatever. And, you're multitasking. And but the thing about that is, your public library is never, ever going to have the kind of books on audio that I am reading for you. So, you few people who are bored by this, go away. Don't bother us. There's a minority of us that you're bothering when you tell me to stop reading books like this. Shut up. People are different. This is a rare opportunity to actually get through this book, this manuscript by Maureen Heaton. And if you ever hear any interview online, or any past interview from Charlotte Iserbeet, I honestly have never heard an interview of her where she does not mention this manuscript by Maureen Heaton and commend it highly. She's always talking about this manuscript. And three or four times in different interviews, I have heard her commend this manuscript, and I kept scratching my head saying to myself, man, I'd like to someday check out this book by Maureen Heaton. What's so cool about it? What's so insightful about it? What does it expose? Well, I'm doing it now for the benefit of myself and for you audio learners in my audience who like audiobooks and know that you'll never find one like this in the library. Anyway, that's it for today. I think it should be noted that as I am taping this show for the first time, I am at work. It's after school. I'm in my classroom, my empty classroom after school taping this. I am a public high school teacher, as some of you know who've listened to past shows. And I'm not allowed to teach. I'm not allowed to teach. Not allowed to teach. What they're doing, and Maureen Heaton, she's going to get into education more, this programmed, robotic, regurgitating education that we call public education in America now. It's criminal. It ought to be criminal. The way we're being required to teach and how we're not being able to teach and what we're not being able to teach, it's just criminal. I mean, it goes way beyond the evolution and atheism thing and the... Oh, boy. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that in there. Yeah, here I am, looking out at these desks, these empty desks, which tomorrow again will be filled with empty skulls that I'm not allowed to fill. Homeschool, folks. What am I doing here? God, I don't... God, help me. Help me out. Get me somewhere.
If I told you now, if I told you now, if I told you now, how would it help? If I told you now, I leave my children here. If I told you now, how would it help you?
This world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. That's true. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. This world is not my home. I'm just passing through. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore.
This world where my children, this world where my children, this world where my children have gone before. This world where my children, this world where my children, this world where my children have gone before.
I can't live at home in this world anymore. I can't live at home in this world anymore.
That is the way things are.